In July of 1991, 10-year-old Tom Walker and 13-year-old Jeff Thalabar were riding their bikes through Waterford, a shore town in New London County, Connecticut. It was a nice day out, so they decided to go to Stenger's Pond to fish. Stenger's Pond was located on an abandoned farm property at the time, so they would have to ride their bikes through there to access the pond. The boys dropped their bikes nearby and ran to the pond, fishing poles in tow, but nothing would prepare them for what would happen to them that hot July day. They had no idea they were being watched.
My name is Caitlin, and this is Wicked, a true crime podcast.
Out of nowhere, three boys approached them. Tom and Jeff had never seen these boys before. As they inched closer and closer to them, one of the boys drew a knife while the other two boys tackled both boys to the ground. The two victims tried to escape to no avail. But Jeff fought back the hardest. Suddenly, he felt a sharp blow to his head and it was lights out from there. One of the boys had hit him with a baseball bat and knocked him unconscious. The three assailants bound both boys' hands behind their backs with tape, put tape across their mouths, and threw them into Stenger's Pond, but that wasn't all. Jeff was hit with the bat again, and the boy went for Tom, too. When the three attackers were satisfied, they threw the fishing rods into the pond and took off with Tom and Jeff's bikes, leaving the boys for dead. They were sure they had drowned them, but what they didn't know was that somehow by a miracle, Tom ducked and narrowly missed the bat. His quick thinking led him to pretend that he was unconscious, and it worked. When it was safe to come out, Tom came out from the shallow water, gasping for air. He managed to free himself from the duct tape and grabbed onto Jeff's body. Tom swam out of the pond and carried him to the nearest house. Tom was considerably smaller compared to Jeff given his age, and yet that little boy used all his strength and adrenaline to run a quarter of a mile to safety. I mean, you want to talk about a guardian angel? That was definitely Tom. Had he not gotten out of the water, they both would have drowned. When the boys got to the house, he laid Jeff in the grass and ran to the door, banging and frantically screaming for someone to help them. A woman opened the door, and what she saw must have shaken her to her core. She ran in to dial 911, then went back out to unbind Jeff's hands from the duct tape. Emergency responders came within minutes and brought the boys to Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London. Tom's fight or flight response would ultimately be what saved his friend. Right away, Jeff was admitted into the ICU. Dr. John Urbanetti, the attending physician that night, was interviewed on Forensic Files for an episode dedicated to this case, and he said that Jeff was, quote, the closest I have ever seen someone come to not surviving. Jeff's head had been split open, he had water in his lungs, and he had multiple bruises and abrasions on him. But his will to live was so much stronger than that baseball bat. Waterford police began to investigate, and Detective Donald McCarthy was assigned to the case. He came to the hospital and spoke to Dr. Urbanetti, absolutely baffled by the fact that Jeff was even alive. Who would do this to anyone, let alone a little boy? Tom was interviewed by the police and went through a play-by-play of what happened. He was able to give a general description of the boys, the baseball bat, and describe the knife. Jeff was eventually able to corroborate the evidence when his condition improved just enough to be able to be interviewed. He made a full recovery and only spent a week in the ICU. The Waterford police and their CSI team had a lot to unpack. They responded to the pond to collect evidence, but there was just one problem. The crime scene was a pond. How were they even supposed to gather evidence? The tackle box and fishing poles had been thrown into the water, the bat was found in a local sewer grate with no fingerprints, and any hairs or fibers the police would have used were gone. They would be in the water. So now what? Well, it was by a long shot, but the police did some neighborhood canvassing. They went door to door knocking, asking if anyone had any information that could be useful to the investigation to come forward. And someone did. Police's big break in the case came from a woman in a nearby New London neighborhood named Debbie, who told the police quite a startling story. Earlier that same day, she heard a knock on her door. When she opened it, a young African-American teenager was standing in front of her. The boy claimed to be a diabetic and asked if he could have anything with sugar. So it almost sounds like he was hypoglycemic. And naturally, Debbie felt bad for him. So despite not knowing who this boy was, she let him come in anyway and she gave him some orange juice to drink. After a few minutes, the boy thanked her for helping him feel better and he left. After shutting the door behind her, Debbie made her way up to the master bedroom to take a shower. As she was about to get undressed, she just happened to be looking in the mirror when she caught the reflection of the window. There, right in her backyard, she caught a glimpse of two teenage boys, one of them a white boy with long red hair and freckles, and the other one, another African-American boy. She kept watching in the reflection and saw that the boy she just had given orange juice to was joining them. But that wasn't the most alarming part. The alarming part was that the second African-American boy was holding a roll of duct tape and a green baseball bat, the same one that would later be found in the sewage drain. The hair on the back of Debbie's neck stood straight up. She quickly ran to the window and opened it, screaming at them to get off her property before she called the police. After hearing the news of the attacks of the two boys at the pond, there was no doubt in her mind that the cases were linked somehow. Incredibly, she was able to give a very detailed description of the boy she had given the orange juice to. He wore glasses and had a unique scar that was U-shaped. This would definitely narrow the candidate pool down. This woman's attention to detail is uncanny. Under the direction of Detective McCarthy and the Chief of Police, Waterford Police Department sent out officers to the Canvassy area searching for the boys. They would find the identity of the redhead, 18-year-old Christopher Green. Brian Davis had been the boy with the scar and glasses. While the other two boys had no prior offenses, Christopher was a known troublemaker in the community. In the short time that he had been alive so far, he had already acquired a long rap sheet that ranged from petty theft to robbery. He could put most adults to shame. When the police brought the boys in for questioning, of course, they denied having any involvement, but upon obtaining a search warrant, what they found would prove otherwise. It was suspected that Christopher Green was the ringleader in the attack, so they applied for a warrant to his home first. The police entered the home and a short time later discovered a knife that matched the description of the one the oldest boy in the attack had told them about. They made their way down to the basement, and there, by the washing machine, was a pair of black sneakers, soaking wet and covered in mud. When questioned, Christopher stated that he had been jumping through puddles in the grass from when it rained on a previous night. When officers collected the shoes as evidence, a previously unheard forensic technique would unveil key facts that debunked Christopher's lies. The police's aha moment came one day when it was suggested to them to reach out to the science department at none other than Connecticut College. It wasn't even 5 minutes away from the Waterford Police Station, so how convenient is that? That saves a lot of money. The police sat down with a professor at the school named Dr. Peter Shiver. He's a forensic limnologist, which is just a fancy way of saying that he's an expert on the characteristics of freshwater systems, such as lakes, rivers, streams, ponds, and wetlands, and non-oceanic salt water. In these bodies of water, there is a specific type of algae called diatom. Diatom are single-celled organisms that are found in oceans and waterways and soils. Diatoms are actually pretty populous, and according to Life Science, they generate about 20 to 50% of the oxygen produced by our planet each year and constitute nearly half the organic material found in our oceans. We can't see diatoms with the naked eye, but under a microscope, they are so freaking cool. I'll post photos on the site's blog post, or if you watch a Forensic Files episode on this case, I'll show you what they look like. They are held in the shell of a type of glass known as silica. Yes, the same stuff you'll find in those little gel packets that come in your shoes. They're made out of that stuff. Dr. Shiver described them in that Forensic Files episode as being like pieces of art, and I have to agree. I don't know why, but they kind of remind me of those little patterns you see in kaleidoscopes. You'll know what I'm talking about if you've ever, you know, looked into a kaleidoscope before. But in any case, each body of water has a unique number of a certain type of diatom and set of species. In this case, it was a crescent-shaped diatom known as Eunotia. When the professor processed these sneakers, he not only found three different species of Eunotia, but he also found a type of algae known as crocophytes. So crocophytes are related to diatoms, but the difference is that unlike diatoms, they could swim. They kind of look like bugs. If Christopher was telling the truth, this unique algae would not be on his sneakers, but it was. This evidence and the information that Debbie provided would ultimately lead to the arrest of Christopher, Brian, and Tristan. They were charged with attempted murder, kidnapping, and robbery. Brian and Christopher were sentenced to a minimum of 18 years in prison. But because Tristan was a juvenile, he was sentenced to juvenile detention to be released at 21 years old, even though he was an accomplice to an attempted murder. He would go on to commit more offenses, and interestingly enough, he was arrested in my area in 2018 for clocking in at 107 miles per hour on the highway. He also has multiple other offenses, so I swear everything comes full circle. It's a small world for sure. Brian Davis also stayed in the cycle of crime. According to a 2013 article in The Patch, he was arrested for a string of charges including possession of narcotics, driving an unregistered vehicle, possession of a controlled substance, and possession of drug paraphernalia. According to an article by journalist Danielle Morton, Christopher Green eventually moved to Louisiana, where his mother relocated to with his brother Sammy after he was jailed. Sammy actually died in a fire in New Orleans in 2010, and that's how I was able to find out the real names of these kids. I was unable to find an update on the boys, but I hope they grew up to have families and are happy and healthy. Sanger's farm was turned into a conservation area with hiking trails. Despite the horrific crimes that were committed that day on the pond, there was something wonderful that came out of it. I know that probably sounds weird given we're talking about true crime, but just bear with me. I had mentioned earlier that diatoms were used to place a suspect at a crime scene, and it was the first of its kind. Well, because of that, it became a landmark case. It received international attention, and shortly after, aquatic forensics was used by Swiss policemen to solve the homicide of a drowning victim. The species in the young boy's lungs matched those of the ones found on the gas pedal of the suspect's vehicle. I mean, how cool is that? My home state isn't known for much besides some negative stereotypes, and if you're from here, you'll know what they are. But to know that in the forensics community, we are known for a landmark case making a positive impact for victims of crime, I think that's so cool. We always talk about a physical fingerprint or a metaphorical digital fingerprint, but we don't really hear about an aquatic fingerprint. Cases that occur on any body of water are difficult to solve, and I hope that more and more police departments hear about this kind of technology and provide access to it.